It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And we'd like to welcome Harvell and Collins. Cecil Harvell, I think we have you on the line. Good morning, Cecil. How are you?
We do. Good morning. Good morning.
He is here. Your partner here doubted that you were on the line, but I said, no, he's right here. Wes Collins is in studio, so the gang is all together.
Yeah,
let's talk.
Know why, so you called in.
Yeah.
So I understand all these blinking lights in the room here.
Hey, we're,
how is the volume this morning so far?
You're coming through fine. You're coming through fine, Cecil.
Good,
very good. So I'm learning the law week by week, and you're learning radio week by week, so it's a fair trade, I'm sure.
It is. That's the way it should be.
Well, what are we going to talk about today, Cecil?
Well, the last couple of times that Wes hasn't been in court, and I'm glad he's here this morning with us, we've kind of deciphered and mystified the litigation process. There's still plenty to talk about with regard to the procedure and the way in which, you know, cases begin. They have a kind of a beginning and a middle and an end.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely have a life of their own. It is, as Wes would say, a world of its own. and so let's continue to talk about that. I described it last week as kind of the process being similar to a funnel, where when you begin and enter the funnel, there's a lot of space. There are a lot of questions. There's a lot of work to be done. What are going to be the documents? Who are going to be the witnesses? What are going to be the issues that really will be before the court? And what issues might get dismissed along the way? And so as we enter the funnel at the beginning of a litigation file, there are lots of unknowns. But as the time progresses, and we move through the funnel, kind of the middle stage of the file is, in fact, or maybe one of the first parts of the file, is the discovery phase, getting the documents, finding out who the witnesses are, and, of course, what they will and will not say. And then, of course, we move toward motions with the court. And finally, of course, the case is docketed, you know, for trial. And as we discussed last week, the judge will rule on matters of law, whether or not the issues are genuine and material, whether or not there's sufficient evidence for a particular issue to go to the jury. The jury, of course, will be impaneled to find facts. You know, does the party have capacity? Who was negligent? Was there negligence in the accident? Things that are of a factual nature. And so let's continue to kind of go through the funnel and talk about some of the stages in more detail.
That's good. Wes, you want to add to that?
Well, you know, as I, you know, listen to Cecil with the overview there, it comes to mind, you know, it may make sense for me to mention a couple of the reasons I have to go to court this week, even just to, you know, give a real life example of, you know, things that litigation attorneys do as cases go forward. For example, yesterday I had to be in Craven County Superior Court at 10 o'clock for the simple purpose of withdrawing from the case. And mm-hmm. that's pretty important that for folks to understand that and to understand why an attorney has to withdraw, why you have to go to court with that. I mean, normally in your typical dealings with people, if you want to withdraw from a situation, you just pick
up
the phone and say,
yeah,
I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. You know,
mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the way that works in the world of litigation is that when you are counsel of record, that means you have signed documents that are in the court file, whether it's a complaint, an answer, you know, a notice of appearance, and therefore you're counsel of record. You're responsible to the court. You're responsible to that client. You can't just walk away from the case. You have to file a motion to withdraw. Now, in that particular case yesterday, the reason that I withdrew from the case was because it was a dispute over access to a certain piece of property and whether or not an easement by prescription or implication or cartway proceeding, cartway easement, would be established. That means the property was landlocked. Okay, I got a little feedback there, I think. The property was landlocked, and there is a legal mechanism for resolving that. Well, one of the things that I did for my client in moving forward with the case is I got his title insurance company to get involved in the case and cover it and provide an attorney for him. Because when my client came to me, his previous lawyer had, because he had a closing attorney that worked on it first,
sure,
tried to get the title company to get involved and to cover his claim, and they declined. They denied that. So kind of issue number one for us was, well, we think, let's analyze this first, and upon the analysis, we made the determination that the title company had an obligation to be involved in this case. So we made a better application for it. They approved it, and now they're paying for his attorney to advance his claim.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So there's no need for him to pay us when he has title counsel. Okay. Sometimes I stay involved in cases in the event there is insurance counsel for various reasons. There wasn't a reason to do it in this particular case. So I have to drive over to New Bern and do a notice of hearing and set the hearing and give everyone notice of it who's involved in the case. If anyone objects, they can raise an objection and then present the order to Judge Willie in this case. Josh Willie, great judge, and he, of course, signed the order because it was unopposed. Mm-hmm. I'll have to serve the order. So there's a lot of pomp and circumstance in just withdrawing from the case. You have to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a relatively simple task in the world of litigation yesterday, but you understand there's still lots of little twists and turns with that.
Right.
Today I have to run over back to New Bern in a case where it's an existing equitable distribution case where one of the an equitable distribution is the division of assets by spouses upon a separation or divorce, where one of the two spouses has passed away. So the law on that used to be that upon a spouse passing away, when you're moving forward through a divorce proceeding, including equitable distribution, the law used to be that that ended it. Okay, well, mm-hmm. that changed by statute several years ago, and now the law on that is that in the event that a party dies while an equitable distribution is proceeding, or if the parties are separated and an equitable distribution is sought, then the estate then takes over the position of the person who's passed away. So our office represents the estate. Cecil and Andrew Foster
mm-hmm.
are doing the estate administration part of the case, which is a very important part of the case, and I'm handling the litigation equitable distribution part of the case. So I have to go to court. First of all, we have to get the executor qualified in the county, letters testamentary issued, go through that process. Then I have to notice up a hearing, have to have the hearing, and then the court considers it and makes sure that everything is done properly, which of course it will be, and enter the order allowing the executor to substitute in as the party as opposed to the person who was the party but who is now deceased. So that's, again, somewhat of a housekeeping type issue,
yeah,
cleaning up the file, but the process in which you have to go through has to be right. It has to be correct. You have to know how these nuances work, the twists and turns of even these simple tasks. And you can't, again, you can't pick up the phone and say, "Judge, I want to substitute in." No,
it's got to be.
You got to be there.
Yeah, in court.
You've got to give the notice of hearing. You've got to go through the process because it could be that there's someone that objects to it. It could be that there's some legal argument that a party does. You know, it's probably not in these two situations, mm-hmm. but it could be that is raised. So, kind of, you know, back to due process. Everyone needs to have the opportunity to raise their issues. You can't have like ex parte decisions, meaning decisions
just by
behind
one.
Closed doors with one party being there.
Right. It's a way, I guess, Cecil, it's a way in layman terms to get everybody on the same page. But in the legal setting of the courtroom before a judge with both parties represented there and everybody given fair notice, and then you move forward from that point on.
Right.
Well, what you're beginning to see with these kind of tidbits of information that Wes is pointing forward about having a court order to no longer be a lawyer in a case, or having a court order to take over the obligations of a former lawyer. I mean, Mike, what's important for our listeners to understand about these issues is to begin to see, you know, the importance, the hierarchy, if you will, that a court of law is placed upon. I mean, this is a very serious place. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see, do we not? All rise. We open the court with a certain decorum. Lawyers dress a certain way. Judges, of course, are in a robe still, even to this day. And what you're beginning to see here is that the court is just not, you know, a happenstance kind of place. I mean, if any lawyer just can get out of a case at any time, resign, no longer represent a party, then what happens, what is the judge supposed to do? I mean, it leaves the judge, would it not, in a lurch.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge is not going to allow that. After all, there is a case before the administration of justice, and there's going to have to be logical ways in which lawyers enter cases, exit cases, so that the administration of justice is not just out there, and we're not existing in kangaroo court. So if you think through this, you understand, you're able to see, yes, Wes even has to get an order to, take himself out of a case. Wes has to get an order in order to substitute himself in a case. And all of this is overseen by the judge so as to make sure that that the case is running smoothly, and that all of the necessary lawyers, parties are before the court, you know, at all times, and when times come. I refer to things that our listeners might hear in some of these extraordinary cases where the judge doesn't even allow a lawyer to exit the case.
I've had that happen.
Yeah.
Denied.
Yeah. Made me stay in the case.
Because you're too deep into it already,
he feels? Well, even in the case I tried a couple of weeks ago, I represented five or six siblings, and two or three of them just were not responsive.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get them on the phone. They didn't live locally. They were just, I don't know what they were doing. Now, the others were saying, yeah, I'm speaking for these other two
sure.
or three. But that made me a little uncomfortable because I wanted to make sure that I knew what all of my clients, what their interest was and what they wanted me to do. So I filed a motion to withdraw only as to those two or three who were not responsive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the judge denied that, and I understand why. We actually had several different motions before the judge at that point in time. So that was one thing that I wanted to bring to the court's attention, that I had two or three clients who weren't communicating. The judge denied that and basically indicated, well, this is a caveat proceeding. I want you to represent everyone's interest in it to make sure everyone has legal counsel. So I'm going to deny your motion to withdraw. And the judge kind of basically read the tea leaves there that, well, all the siblings are in the same boat anyway.
Yeah.
So if you represent one of them, you're really representing all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to be clear in the court file that I did what was necessary and everything I could do to try to withdraw when I had some people who were not speaking with me. It's not that they were mad or anything. It's just, I guess they figured their siblings were taking care of it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I've had that happen. Absolutely.
Cecil, I'm sure listeners know, you know, the judge that sits before you and hears these cases, they're elected officials. Some may not realize that, but they are. They're elected officials. The term that we hear about attorneys in court, that you're officers of the court. What does that mean? Officer mm-hmm. of the court.
Yeah, sure. Well, we are officers of the court in all matters, even in estate matters. In filing of deeds in the register of deeds, if we were real estate lawyers, no matter what area of the law we happen to practice, we are also officers of the court. And that's a great question, Mike, and it's basically a question that means the following. It means that we are held accountable for our actions mm-hmm. by our licensing organization, which is the State Bar of North Carolina, for Wes and myself. Each and every state has a state bar, a State Bar of Florida, State Bar of South Carolina. We are responsible to the State Bar of North Carolina. And this is a regulatory bar that reviews any kinds of matters as to the propriety of what a lawyer might or might not do. And so in order to keep the judicial system, which is one of our fundamental institutions of American government, in order to hold it to the highest level, the lawyers themselves are now part of that. To be licensed, to be granted a license, to be an officer of the court, means that you have to then, of course, abide by the rules and regulations that are set forth by your particular state bar. You're not going to be able to hinder this institution of justice. You're not going to be able to harm it in any way. You have an ethical obligation to hold yourself and your actions, you know, at a very high level, so that you are assisting at all times in the administration of justice, and you are not misrepresenting or acting in any kind of fraudulent way, which of course anything of that nature, as one would suspect, would, you know, bring down this very highly respected and necessary institution of government.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you can't make false filings before a court. You can't make false statements before a clerk or before a judge. You need to know, if you as a lawyer, witness or are part of something, or even if you just happen to notice that there is something that is inappropriate that is happening in our, administration of justice, through our courts system, you know, it's your obligation to bring that to the attention of the appropriate person. Because again, you are an officer of the court. You are someone that is assisting and being a part of this very important institution of the administration of justice. You're a part of it. And that's what the words officer of the court mean.
That's a great explanation. Let's take a break on that. We'll come back with more Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. If you'd like to contact the Moorhead City-based law firm, call 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back after this quick timeout. Back to Let's Talk Legal. In studio, we have Wes Collins, and on the phone, we have Cecil Harvell. And gentlemen, we're going to take it right to the top of the hour, so use our time here. I'll give it to you, Wes.
Sure. So we have 4 or 5 minutes left. So going back to, you know, what I discussed with regard to withdrawing from the case, I mean, that's, I think, important for listeners to understand that, you know, if I'm in the case, even if there's insurance counsel who is handling the case for the party. Okay, I represent the person, but then we're able to get title insurance counsel involved. So they're, you know, carrying the laboring oar at that point in time, and I'm really not doing much of anything or just monitoring the case. Well, if the case doesn't go well and I have it withdrawn, then I'm still liable to my client on that. So I am responsible to my client and to the court from beginning to end until I withdraw. But as soon as I withdraw from the case and I get that order from the court, then my responsibility ends. But it does not end until I get that order. So now, in the case that I was talking about had to go to court yesterday simply for withdrawing from the case since the court entered that order. Now I can close that file. I don't have to monitor anything. I don't have to be concerned about, you know, what decisions are being made by title counsel. I don't have to respond to motions. I'm not served anything else in the case. I'm out of it completely. But that's an important, you know, issue for folks to understand that, you know, if I, you know, I've got a lot of cases going on at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't forget a detail. I mean, you can't let a detail, you know, miss, you know, go by. I mean, you've got to be on top of everything with every single case. And you can't just say, well, I'm sure it'll be fine. He has title insurance counsel now. He's going to do everything. I'm sure it'll be good. No, you can't. You just cannot do that as an attorney. Once it's appropriate for you to withdraw, and under these circumstances, the client is in support of that, then you need to go ahead and do that so that you're out of the case completely. You close the file. You have no further responsibility, and case closed, done as far as I'm concerned.
Clean separation.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very important important issue. So, you know, we have a couple minutes left, but, you know, other things that we kind of touched on is, you know, and what we started 2 or 3 weeks ago was the different times of the case where the case potentially gets dismissed. So I do want to just revisit that very briefly. Normally the way that goes is it goes 12B, summary judgment, directed verdict. Okay, and what does that mean, Collins? Well, a 12B is a motion to dismiss. That could be under several different grounds. It could be lack of jurisdiction, meaning it was filed in the wrong court. There could be potentially a venue issue. There could be failure to join a necessary party. There could be things that can be easily fixed, and normally things that can be easily fixed, such as the issues I just went through, that would be a dismissal without prejudice, meaning it's dismissed, but you can rebring it. You can fix your problem.
Correct it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
A 12B6 is different. A 12B6 is failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. That means that even if we take, and we have 1 minute left, even if we take the allegations of the complaint as true, you haven't pled a proper case.
Mm-hmm.
So that a lot of times happens early on because that's just based on what is pled in the pleadings. Next is summary judgment. That means we've done a little discovery or maybe a lot of discovery. So, and we gathered information that indicates that there's no genuine issue of material fact. So that's a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment that, again, normally happens a little bit further down the line in the case. And the judges or the parties have gotten some discovery, and the judge hears a summary of the facts and makes that determination of the evidence. And then directed verdict is at trial. That means that at the close of a party's evidence, it could be, you know, just after the plaintiff's evidence, after both parties' evidence, whatever, then I know we're almost done, then the court can consider a dismissal.
Very good. A lot of moving parts in a case, Cecil. And I think what Wes is describing there is you have to dot your I's and cross your T's because if you miss one, it could blow the whole case. That's a great conversation, gentlemen. And perhaps we'll continue this next Tuesday when we get together again and let's talk legal. If you'd like to call the firm today, call 252-726-9050. Or you can go online to HarvellandCollins.com for more information. We'll do this again next Tuesday at 7:30. Thank you, Wes.
Thanks,
Thank
Mike.
You, Cecil.